You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There are faces you don't see much on film, men who've spent too many nights on the street with too many excuses. They are the people in Lionel Rogozin's landmark film from 1956 called On the Bowery. It's being shown in a new 35mm print at the Film Forum starting today. With me now by phone from France to tell us about the making of this remarkable movie is Lionel's son, Michael Rogozin, and Rob Hollander, who is the co-founder of the Lower East Side History Project, who's in the studio. We're glad to have you both on the program.
Hey, Miles.
Hello.
Hello, Michael. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, everything's fine from over here.
Excellent. You sound great. Michael, tell us a little bit about how your father came to this subject. What was it about the Bowery and telling this story in documentary form, verite form, at its time, breakthrough form? What was it about the Bowery that, drew him?
Well, actually, we didn't know that much about his motivations and the real story behind the making of this film until rather recently, because actually my father didn't talk about it often. He was always talking about new projects and things he wanted to do. So we only discovered this after his death and some video interviews were done and writings. But he said actually that he actually made On the Bowery as a, to learn how to make films, and he had another project in mind, which he couldn't do without knowing how to make films because it was a rather dangerous and risky project. That's what he said. I also know that the film, just so people know,
the film that you're referring to is a movie called Come Back Africa, which got into the issue of apartheid. This is back in 1960, so he was kind of ahead of his time. So as much as anything, he was trying to learn his craft, and there it was right near him, near home.
Yes, exactly. And the thing is that he was as somebody who was extremely politically conscious of things. And, well, supposedly he lived down in Greenwich Village in Perry Street, and he would see the Bowery men very close by, and he was very affected by them. And he had one experience trying to make a short film or working on a short film, and then he decided that he had made his decision to go into films because actually his work is often was really motivated by his political consciousness. And he had thought of doing several different careers, either working for the UN or being a journalist. And he picked films because he had been affected by some films in his childhood, for instance, Robert Flaherty's Nanook. And so he had he decided that he wanted to be a filmmaker. He saw the men, and he said, that's the subject. That's a powerful subject.
So he was a filmmaker really on a cause. He had a mission when he made a film.
Yes, and in fact, he had come back from the war, and he thought that something had to be done to change the world and all. So the fact that he picked the Bowery Man, I think, is no accident. But as I say, he claimed it was to prepare himself to make a film, and he was going to originally make a short. And as he began to get into the subject, he said there's a real film in this. And, of course, the way he went about making it is so particular that it has a lot to do with actually how he went on to work, his style, I would say.
Yeah, we want to talk about that a little bit more in just a moment, but let's set the scene a little bit here. I'm going to bring Rob in, Rob Hollander, who is co-founder of the Lower East Side History Project. The Bowery of today, we would not recognize the Bowery of the mid-1950s. It was a very different place. Flop houses, cheap gin mills, lots of alcoholics lying on the sidewalk, mostly men, mostly white, interestingly, a few women, but paint the picture for us.
Well, the Bowery was sort of a ghost town right in the middle of New York. The Bowery had once been the most exciting street in New York. It was the commercial district, it was the theater district, it was the nightlife district. When the Third Avenue L was built in 1878, it drove out all the legitimate businesses and left only the illegitimate, the underground, which sort of thrived in the shadows. And as a result, the Bowery became a skid row for most of the 20th century. It was a place that people did not want to go to unless you were kind of marginal.
Unintended consequences. You build mass transit, happens to be above ground, and it changes neighborhood profoundly.
Oh, yeah, the Bowery became actually kind of a unique spot in New York. If you have a ghost town anyplace else, there's really nothing left. It's a wasteland. But this was right in the middle of Manhattan, and it became kind of a draw, not only for hobos all over America, but also a lot of artists. One thing that you don't see in the film is that there were hundreds of artists who were living in those buildings. They weren't as visible because they weren't sleeping out in the streets.
Interesting. So, and of course, the film stays focused like a laser beam on these men who are in desperate need of help. Michael, what's interesting about this movie is it's a combination of real life documentary footage and very stark and in its own horribly sad way beautiful, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And and yet there is also a script here. Part of it is, it's not that there's actors, but there were real people of the Bowery who were given kind of a plot line by your father. Explain that. I guess that was more common in the 1950s when you were doing a documentary. You had these big cumbersome cameras. You sort of had to set things up. Explain that.
Well, I think so. My father was affected by neorealism, De Sica, and the films like The Bicycle Thief. He was following that tradition and kind of combining it with Flaherty, which is more ethnological. But I think he had his own unique style. He developed a lot of, well, when we've done the research for the documentary we made, we were very surprised to find how much of his style was conscious, actually, of what he wanted to do in his methods of improvisation, for example. But basically, I think that what makes it a beautiful film and is that they didn't want to, the team who was working on the film, my father, didn't want to put his ideas on these people who are the Bowery men. He wanted to let them express themselves, and I think that's very symbolic of my father's work in general. But I think it's also he had a tremendous empathy for these men who were, as Rob said, you know, coming to this place, which was the last stop or whatever, and, you know, where people could go when they had nowhere else to go. So he had a tremendous, actually, relationship with the men. I think that comes through as the humanity, even though, and actually the complexity of these people who normally would be, you know, could be scared to talk to in the street, you know. So, I think that gives the rich quality of this film, you know, which takes it above a lot of other films.
It focuses on the 3 days in the life of the Bowery, but in particular, the one of the main characters is Ray Salyer, who is a former railroad worker from New Jersey who comes into the Bowery and meets another key person, Gorman Hendricks. And right. those are real people, right? At first I thought, Ray Salyer, I thought, oh, is that an actor? It wasn't, right?
No, there are no real actors. There are people who my father picked. Ray is rather good looking, so people thought he was, you know, an actor.
Yeah, he had actor looks, yeah.
He had good looks. My father thought he had a career after that, and he was offered, there was quite a few offers from Hollywood, but it was way beyond his capacity to stop drinking. And my father tried, and I think offered to pay for rehab and all kinds of things. He was extremely close to the men, but he couldn't change. So
I'm speaking with Michael Rogozin, who is the son of Lionel Rogozin, the legendary filmmaker who directed, produced On the Bowery, and Rob Hollander, who is the co-founder of the Lower East Side History Project. And if you want to see the movie, go to our show page at WNYC.org, and we'll set you up with some times there. One of the things that's central to this, Rob, is the Bowery mission. And at a certain point in the movie, Ray Salyer goes to the mission. He ends up not liking it so much. Matter of fact, why don't we, if we could, we have a little piece of the film which shows it's kind of... you know, there's a certain almost, there's a comic element to this portion where they sort of announce the rules to the overnight guests, if you will, of the mission. Let's listen.
In the first place, you have to stay in here all night. You have to have a bath. You have to put your clothes in the fumigator. You have to wash your small clothes. You have to shave. All those things you have to do before you can have a bed, and then we'll give you a bed. Now listen, when you come in here, you leave the booze outside. Forget all about Sneaky Pete. He's a thing of the past with you. When you come in here, stay sober. Because when you give the ticket, that's a contract that you're going to stay sober as long as you hold that ticket. The minute you come to the front door in the evening, at 6 o'clock, to come down here, The man will see whether you've had a drink or not. If you're under the influence of liquor, you cannot sleep in the dormitory. The dormitory is clean, the beds are clean, there's a shower up there and a place to shave. Everything is there for your use.
Yeah, now see here, guys, you know, it's almost like Damon Runyon, but this is real, right?
Absolutely.
The mission, it was central to the Bowery, the whole reason this movie was made, but it still exists, right?
The Bowery mission is still there. It's still helping a lot of people. Its orientation is maybe a little bit different. It expects inmates to stay for maybe 6 months. They do training. They place people out afterwards. So it's a little bit a different kind of an orientation because, of course, the Bowery has changed as well.
Is there still a clientele lining up there every night, though? I mean, are there people in the Bowery still in need of that mission?
The Bowery mission offers a free lunch. It's one of the best soup lines in the city. And they bring people from, they bring sort of missions from other places in America to help out. It's a major institution, really, in New York.
Michael, the mission was very important to your father, as I understand it. He really, as going back to what you were originally saying, he wasn't trying just to make movies that shock people or entertain people. He really wanted to change the world. And part of this was to show that there is the possibility of redemption. Is that correct?
That's a difficult question. I don't know really exactly. I think the way they went about making the scenario or whatever, the film would be to... Since my father actually spent, just to make it clear, 6 months living on the Bowery, very, you know, there every day before filming. So he knew the whole lifestyle and what was possible or not. So he felt that was an important part of the film. I don't have that much. I couldn't really answer that completely honestly, why he put it in. Was it to give hope? Was it part of their life situation? It's hard for me. I can't honestly really give a real – it's something I'm not – knowledgeable enough about to say.
Well, let me ask you this. Did this movie change the world? Or the Bowery, for that matter?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer it directly.
How about you, Rob?
It's a great piece of history. Because if you look at the Bowery today, it's unrecognizable. You have the Bowery Hotel. You have the Cooper Square Hotel. There are hotels being built all over the Bowery. Some of them you won't see because the recession has sort of lost the financing. So you have these huge pits along the Bowery. But those are going to be built eventually.
They will be filled, yes. And I did a quick search before we came on. I just did studio apartment mm-hmm. Bowery, $2,300 bucks. So the Bowery has mm-hmm, changed quite a bit, right?
It used to be the White House flophouse was $5 a night.
And it's still there as a hostel now, right? The White
House.
That's
what they call themselves now.
And you can see, so students go there, or it's SRO type stuff, right? Is that it?
They still have the cubicles. They still have the kitchen wire over the ceiling, or rather than a ceiling.
The chicken wire?
You can see it in the movie.
There's a great scene where he shoots through the chicken wire into one of these little cubicles that the doc is in, and that's a stunning scene. You get a sense of. Yeah, there's this kind of conflict between this sense of, as you pointed out, the freedom of the Bowery mm-hmm. to do whatever you want, and yet they're all kind of in prison, aren't they?
Well, they're in a prison of themselves.
Of their own doing.
But as I say, you know, the slums and the Bowery had this wonderful sense of freedom. Nobody was looking at you. Nobody cared about you. The slumlord was not there. The police really didn't care about you very much. Every once in a while, they'd round people up. But that's what drew people to the Bowery. You could be there and not worry about the rest of mainstream world. And even the artists, we interviewed a lot of artists in researching this project. And a lot of them said, you know, we'd leave the Bowery and we'd feel very uncomfortable. And when we came back to the Bowery, we felt like home.
So, you know, on the one hand, I'm sure the Bowery of 1956 with the L and the flop houses, you wouldn't want that to come back, but I know you're ambivalent about the change that occurs there. Gentrification carries with it a lot of it erases the past in some sense, right?
You know, it seems to me that a great city has to have all kinds of places, and there's no reason why there shouldn't be a place for the marginals, a place for the derelicts, a place for cheap rents for artists. That's what the Bowery afforded to artists. And, of course, it came along with the desperation as well. But it isn't all desperation. There's a kind of vitality that's beyond revenue, that's beyond money. A city is not, here I'm lecturing now, a city is not just a business, although our mayor seems to think that that's all it is.
Good luck, my friend. Good luck. Michael, put your father's movie here into some perspective. This was groundbreaking stuff. I know that he looked to Robert Flaherty, Nanook of the North, but this movie broke ground and really influenced documentaries to come, did not. Give us the historical perspective.
Well, I think, it was the beginning of the New American Cinema, which is a group of filmmakers in the late 50s, early 60s, that still today have not come into their own or are just beginning to be appreciated because they made films that were very eclectic and varied, but they that were, not following the Hollywood rules. And I think that was their one rule. Let's make films that we can, without following the rules of certain ways of making films. And my father was a central part of that, not only with his films, but as a distributor and the Bleecker Street Cinema, which he founded, and where a lot of young filmmakers showed their films. So along with Jonas Mekas, Shirley Clark, Sidney Myers, it was an important generation who didn't get really weren't able to make the films they wanted to make, though they made enough to affect the history of films. I think also we don't appreciate that this new American cinema had a lot of influence on other cinemas, and I believe even the New Wave, for instance, that is much more well-known, was influenced by these films. I think Truffaut said without The Little Fugitive, which was Morris Engel's film, which was of the same generation just around the time of On the Bowery, that the New Wave wouldn't have been come into existence. So it's a very important period, a very short but important period of American film history. And my father was a very central part. And On the Bowery, Comeback Africa, and I think his later films, which we will have to discover, are very important films. As you say, On the Bowery is so unique because there's so much humanity. He's so close to the people that you don't know if you're living there a story. It has the charm of the Mark Twain stories or, the characters who are so real, but who are actually real at the same time. So I think, it's a very important film. And I think that the unique quality of my father's films have to do, I think, with the way he improvised with people and his real love of the human face. I mean, that may sound strange, but if you see all his work, and I think when you see the man's face, you see all the humanity. And that's the photography, which also, I must say, in On the Bowery, there was one of America's great cinematographers who unfortunately died after the film a few years later. His name is Richard Bagley, who did a remarkable job also. So it was a great team, a great moment. And for a first film, it was actually miraculous, I think. I've seen it many times. We've restored the film with the Cineteca di Bologna, who have done the restoration. And I've seen the film many times. And every time I see it, I see something new. I say, how is that possible?
Yeah.
After 10 times, it's still that. I didn't see that before.
Michael
Rogerson.
So it's
kind of magical.
Thank you. It's magical, and it is somehow through all of that, it is not exploitive. He had just the right touch. Michael Rogerson is the son of Lionel Rogerson, the legendary filmmaker of On the Bowery, and Rob Hollander is the co-founder of the Lower East Side History Project. On the Bowery will be showing at the Film Forum for the next week. For more information, you can head to our show page at WNYC.org. Rob and Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.